campfires and trails filled my head, and the sound of nearby crickets seemed transformed into the roar of night jungle sounds that awaited us in Peru. We talked together of our plans and our future. The future seemed enormous and open before us. It was in that evening that we both became committed to a family and a life together. It was a large turning point for me, I have no doubt. We walked together outside and stood beneath the stars near the sheds and gardens where we daily pursued the yet more perfect cultivation of the mushroom. The night was uncannily still and the sky blazing with stars. Looking to the southern sky, I thought, if you are out there, if you approve the course we have set our lives on, if the mystery is real, then give a sign. I stepped toward Kat, who was walking in front of me, to say, I asked them for a sign. But before I could speak, the sky was rent from mid-heaven to horizon with a crimson streak of meteoric fire. The depth of attunement of psyche and world must be very great for such synchronisms to occur. Such meteor burns occur but once in all time, came the mushroom's comment, clear and unbidden into my mind. We sat down then on the warm, receptive earth and abandoned ourselves to the waves of vision and the vistas. At one point, a revolving night wind whipped the leaves of the otherwise perfectly still trees. The district was a remote one, but borne on the still air over miles and miles from neighbors and ranches scattered far, we could hear the mournful howl of every dog in that whole part of the island. For hours, they moaned and howled in eerie, wavering ululation. We could not imagine what it meant, but took it as a coincidence as inexplicable as the sky sign on our future. Hours later, in the time of the false dawn, and at 4:49 local time, according to seismic instruments scattered around the planet, the earthquake struck, a low grinding roar moving through the lava field, stretching for miles all around and beneath us. Tidal waves and volcanic activity at Kilauea near the epicenter and 30 miles away from us followed fast on the first shock. An hour later, another smaller shockwave would occur. Now the reason for the hours of howling were starkly explained. So it is a fact that meteoric signs and a great earthquake, the most intense in Hawaii in 100 years, attended our mushroom trip and our intensified exploration of the psilocybin depths, just as we attended them. The second, and in many ways more puzzling, major mushroom experience that we shared in Hawaii brought to an end any further exploration of mushroom psilocybin until after our return from the Peruvian Amazon. It was the 23rd of December, a day before Dennis would arrive to spend the Christmas holidays with us. Kat and I each again took 5 grams and settled down before the fireplace to await the first wave of images. Soon we were deep out into it. The mushroom was showing me a watery blue-green planet with no land except a globe-girdling archipelago at the equator, a kind of super Indonesia. Accompanying the views of the planet was a narration explaining that this oxygen-rich world was within 100 light-years of Earth and was totally uninhabited by higher animals. As the implications of this last bit of data came home, I felt a wave of acquisitiveness that seemed to come right out of my primate roots and a million years of nomadism and restless swelling of human populations. The narration was explaining that when the symbiotic fusion of humanity and the Stropharia was completed, man would be free to claim many such planets for the Stropharia. The narration had become personified into the inner voice that attends the mushroom trance, and with it I began a discussion of the view of the watery planet and the technology such views implied. I wondered after the technology of star travel and whether the mushroom, for all the extravagant images it is able to bestow, could produce any effect in the normal continuum. I had the idea that we should go outside, as we usually did at some point in our trips, and had a vague intimation that we might see some continuation of the cloud-related phenomena that had been a part of the experience at La Chorrera. Cat complained of being very hot and agreed we should go outdoors. We were very unsteady on our feet, and though Cat said very little, I felt considerable alarm for her, even though when she said that she was hot, I assumed that going outdoors would be sufficient to cool her off. Outside, we stood unsteadily in the front yard. The night was overcast. Cat seemed to be lapsing in and out of consciousness. It was becoming harder and harder to rouse her. She kept saying that they were burning her, but that she thought she could hold them back. Finally, she collapsed altogether, and I could not get any response. My first thought was to realize how isolated we were, and how impossible it would be to get any sort of outside help. It would take hours to get anyone there, and doubtless there was no one who knew more than we did about psilocybin on the entire island. Besides, the overwhelming gestalt of the situation was somehow that we had been placed by something in the scales of life and death, and that whatever was to be done, it was to be done by us alone and in the next very few minutes. I remembered then that at the back of the house, near where we were accustomed to taking sun baths, there was a large tub of water that held the overflow from our catchment system. It required, even in the face of a mortal threat, which I recognized this to be, a complete organization of my consciousness to think of emptying the water over Cat. But as soon as I thought of it, it seemed to give the swirling world a direction. I picked her up in a single sweeping motion and carried her, us lurching through the dark, past the spiky palm, fantastic in the darkness. I laid her on the ground and began to empty can after can of clear black and silver silken water over every inch of her. It was immediately apparent that we had found the limiting factor of whatever was making her feel a burning sensation and forcing her into unconsciousness. Tearfully and joyously embraced there in the water and the mud, both sensing that this very uncharacteristic effect of the mushroom had been a close call, as we knelt together with the realization that we had surmounted the difficulty that had risen to confront us, a wild peal of unearthly sound, a howling laughter, split the air from the direction of the ancient wood behind the house. Neither of us mentioned it then, but later we agreed that it had been very real and unsettling. We stumbled back into the house, and I made a tea while Cat talked to me and candidly confided that she was experiencing what must be like being insane. She described having very frank hallucinations with her eyes open, strange, tangible fern and orchid-like forms growing and twisting out of every available surface. The previous sensation of heat was now resolved down into a field of white-hot potential energy that could be held away from burning contact with her body by allowing the hallucinogenic energy to spend itself in a chaos of weird and explicit images. Only by applied concentration could she hold the burning plasma at bay, a few feet away from her, where it became a skin of vision and encompassed everything else. After a few minutes of this, Cat again seemed to be fading, and so we drew a cold bath, and she lay in that for a while until the symptoms again abated. As we talked, it became apparent that her experience had dimensions for her that had not been apparent to me. When we had first stepped out of the house, she discovered that the sensation of heat had not diminished but only grown stronger. Then she had noticed that directly above her was a disk of light and color, a giant Tinker Toy assemblage of softly glowing rods of light with jewel-like connectors emanating every color. I understood, she told me, that the relationships of the pieces, their lengths, their angles to each other, was infinitely complex and also the embodiment of perfect truth. By seeing it, I was understanding everything.
But there were creatures inside the vehicle, mantis-like and also made of light, that didn't want me to know. Bending over their instrument panels, the more I understood, the more they burned me with their ray. I couldn't stop looking, but I was being vaporized. I felt you pick me up, and as you carried me, I thought, I hope he hurries. I am becoming a cloud. For a moment, I was floating above, looking down at us, people bigger than life, out of time. Then I felt the water on my skin, redefining the limits of my body, condensing me again.
Kat's impression of the situation was that this was not a threat conveyed by the mushroom, but a force inside the continuum that the mushroom makes available, a force that is seemingly morally ambiguous. Kat was having a UFO close contact experience while I was seeing nothing. It was a contact fraught with danger and the threat of extinction. It had abruptly terminated when I had taken her back to the water. We sat up all night discussing what had happened. It served to accentuate other odd things that we had noticed when taking psilocybin in that remote environment. We had particularly noticed small scratchings and rustlings at the periphery of sense and vision during the trips, not unlike the activation of a classic poltergeist phenomena. These small movements and noises were so regular a feature of these experiences that I came to simply accept them. We also noticed waves of organization or anti-entropic swells that seemed to sweep through animate and inanimate matter alike during the mushroom voyages. For instance, after a prolonged period of near trance in contemplation of the visions, if we were to draw away from it in a collective motion to stretch or talk, then the fire would suddenly flare and burn brighter and the rustling at the periphery increase. We were definitely at the brink of the same dimension that I had been plunged into at La Chirera, again brought there by the agency of the mushroom. This time, however, we took our threat-laden brush with the thing as an admonition to ease up for a time. We formed the determination to go to Peru and to take ayahuasca, whose chemistry and reputation might, we thought, be helpful in giving some perspective on the nature of psilocybin relative to other psychochemicals. Our walks in the rainforests of Hawaii were pale but real prefigurement of Amazon trails once followed in the past and in a few months to be traveled again. It was during one of those walks, reflecting on her UFO experience, that Kat pointed out that a lens is the natural result of the overlapping of two spheres. Is there more than a pun involved in applying this idea to the lens-shaped UFO? Perhaps some topological truth is implied in the thought that the lens is caused by the overlapping of one continuum with another. Lenticular clouds were a part of the UFO contact that I was caught up in at La Chirera in 71. This theme reemerged during those psilocybin experiences in the desolate landscapes of rural Hawaii. On yet another mushroom trip, when Kat and I stepped outside late at night, we beheld the stars through the moving interstices of a high lacework of thin clouds. Yet hovering only a few hundred feet above and slightly in front of us was a very dark, dense lenticular cloud. It grew more solid appearing even as we watched. Then suddenly this tendency was reversed and it began to thin and fade very quickly. Then it was gone. Years go by and there is little intrusion of the peculiar into things. Then suddenly it is with us again, effecting coincidence and appearing to channel the flow of events towards some end, sensed but not understood. The current wave of paranoid fiction, gravity's rainbow, Illuminatus, Ratner's star, etc., make feedback from the collective difficult to evaluate. Man is always a creature in transformation. This imparts to every moment deeply felt a sense of the mystery of any future unrealized. Is the present situation any different from many others in the past? Novelty is always in the process of emergence, but does it ever emerge explicitly, suddenly, from the events in which it is embedded? Suddenly enough for us to recognize it as a true flux of the temporal continuum? It does, I believe, in miracles and ecstasy and in situations where forces are seen at work that are undescribed by today's physics. It is necessary to reiterate these familiar threads of thought, for if this is not done, then no record exists of whatever steps we have taken toward understanding psilocybin and its relation to the UFO, the knot of anomaly that seems to haunt time like a ghost. Chapter 20, The Oversoul as Saucer. There is building in global society an increasingly intense expectation of the intervention into human history by UFOs. It is very similar in tone to the buildup of messianic expectation in the Hellenistic world in the several centuries preceding the birth of Christ. The leaders of Roman society may have been caught off guard by the appearance of Christ, but they had no one to blame but themselves, since millions of people in the ancient world were expectantly awaiting some kind of Messiah. So today, science and government poo-poo the idea of world contact with the UFOs, while the contact cults grow ever larger and more insistent that contact is about to occur. Imagine, therefore, what you may never have seriously imagined before. Imagine what would happen if the UFOs were to appear. Imagine a spaceship of the close encounters of the third kind variety, suddenly appearing in orbit around the Earth. Television and mass media would carry its image to every man, woman, and child on the planet. Governments would be paralyzed. Science would be helpless to explain where it came from or how it got here. Millenarian hysteria would break out everywhere. The UFO would be hailed as savior and denounced as antichrist. The end of the world would appear imminent, and all this would occur before the contact was more than a visual image. Then the UFO would begin its revelation. Vast displays of beneficent power can be expected. Perhaps it would mysteriously neutralize all weapons of mass destruction. Or it might use some sort of ray to cure all terrestrial cancer. Whatever it does, one may be sure that its actions will be impressive. Its actions will convert millions to the UFO religion in a space of hours. Indeed, its actions will be specifically designed to overwhelm us with the reality of its power and presence. That will close the first stage of the revelation. The second stage will be the teachings. Telepathically imparted, the specifics of the teachings cannot be anticipated, but they will urge love, voluntary simplicity, concern for one another, renunciation of war, perhaps renunciation of the destructive application of science. Whatever the teachings, the UFO will promise immense reward to those who follow them and dire consequences for those who do not. And the teachings will be delivered in so poetically perfect a way, so rich in understanding and appealing nuances, that no one will doubt their origin in a being wise and good and immensely superior to ourselves. The delivery of the teachings will set the stage for the third and last and most shocking phase of the revelation, the departure. The saucer, promising vaguely to return, will simply disappear. The entire process could take less than a month. If this seems a short time, recall that the entire public career of Christ lasted only 3 years. Christ's career occurred in a world where information could move no faster than a horse's gallop. Yet 3 years in one small part of the world was all that was necessary to launch a world religion that was vital for 1500 years. In a world of electronic communication, the impact of the saucer's arrival, miracles, teaching, and departure would be incalculable, even if it all occurred within a month. The saucer would leave in its wake a science utterly unable to provide any answers to the important questions concerning what had gone on. The vast majority of people would be fanatical converts to the teachings of the saucer, and any institution in opposition to those teachings could expect to be swept away almost overnight. The departure of the UFO would create a sense of abandonment, the agony of which could be expected to echo in the human psyche for centuries. The only panacea would be the religion of the saucer, the religion left behind. Science would be discredited and soon abandoned in favor of 1,000 or more years of exegesis of the saucerian message. Is it not a familiar pattern in the light of our discussion of Christ and Rome? What will never be said in the wake of such an event, and so must be said now, while there is still time, for all of the above could occur and yet still be deception. A benign deception, designed to save us from our advanced science and infantile ethics, but a deception nevertheless. The saucer, no matter how alien it appears, no matter how advanced its demonstrations of power, is not a vehicle from some other star system. It is the oversoul of humanity up to its oldest trick. If one knows this, one can live through the revelation and the destruction of our scientific world, and yet evade the immense power of this most powerful of all transference phenomenon, and thereby maintain the integrity of one's own soul and spirit. Remember, I am not a debunker of flying saucers or a defender of science. I am a contactee, and this book is the painstakingly told story of my own involvement with the UFOs. I am one of those Vallée has pinpointed as being a carrier of ideas that paved the way for the scenario I have just described. Yet, from it all, I have learned that there is no religious revelation more satisfying than the hard-won fruits of simple understanding. And there is no liberation to compare with freeing oneself from the illusions and delusions of the age in which one lives. I reached these conclusions through my use and familiarity with psilocybin and other psychedelic drugs. They immerse their user in the world of the Oversoul and make one privileged to at least a part of its mechanics of operation. They allow a private dialogue with the Oversoul that is outside the context of the struggle between science and revelation, that leaves no choice between the alienation of the rationalist and the tired formulas of the fanatic believer. Psychedelic drugs hold out the possibility of healing the breach between science and morality at the level of the individual, thus freeing one to evolve independent of the chaos and transformation the UFOs may soon bring to humanity. Valet's recent book, Messengers of Deception, vibrates with fear of the unconscious and alienation from the matrix of the larger psyche out of which rational thought has emerged. He fears the destruction of rationalism and scientific thought, yet never once does he mention the potential world-wrecking crisis that the undirected development of science and technology has brought into being. He paints himself as an open-minded investigator of UFOs, yet never questions the motives of the retired and unnamed intelligence officers in which he places so much faith. It is impossible that the CIA is unaware of the social impact belief in UFOs is having. If they were unaware of it before, then surely the recent writings of Valet himself must have alerted them to the potential challenge UFO beliefs pose to orthodox institutions. Based on Valet's own ideas of an informational struggle between rational and irrational elements, how was he able to ignore the possibility that the mutilations which he is so eager to connect with UFOs are nothing more than a government agency's clumsy attempt to discredit the genuine UFO phenomenon? It is a typical method of the intelligence community to discredit human groups it opposes by faking atrocities in such a way that they appear to have been committed by the group whose discrediting is sought. Valet gives examples of this, but never suspects that some government agency might be using this technique to impede the transfer of loyalties from political institutions to the UFOs. He mentions the proximity of animal mutilations to high-security government installations, but never suggests this might be because such installations are the source of these mutilations. Few UFO sightings involve confusion among witnesses over whether or not what they saw was a UFO or a helicopter. Yet in the animal mutilation cases, many witnesses insist a helicopter was involved. Valet is at pains to say no physical evidence of a UFO has ever been collected. Yet later he passes over the fact that a quite ordinary surgical scalpel was found at one cattle mutilation site. It seems possible to me that some people in government have read Valet and are familiar with his theories regarding UFOs as a factor introducing shifts in belief systems and institutional loyalties on a global scale. Without knowing what UFOs really are, these persons and agencies have launched smokescreen operations designed to cast doubt on the motives and harmlessness of UFOs, and so to retard or halt the shift of loyalties and beliefs now reaching epidemic proportions. I suspect that Valet's book may be the opening shot in a media war whose purpose will be to connect the occult, right-wing fanaticism, and animal mutilations to the UFO, all in an effort to cast doubt on the vast power and benign intent of the saucer phenomenon.